stellar co-authors.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Marnie. So today I'm going to speak a little bit about a topic that Miriam introduced on Monday. She was using all of this machinery that was developed with the life-changing sugar fusion myself, and applied it to get a very general framework for cactus. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what came before we reached cactuses, and try to give you a little bit more in-depth view of what this split decomposition is like. Okay, so the motivation is that we want to be able to enumerate large classes of graph in a as general way possible, but we also want precise and exact enumeration. And to do so, we use an idea that's been out there for a long time that many people have done before, which is to use a tree decomposition, which are a lot easier to count. And the tree decomposition that we use is called the split decomposition. And what was very nice about this decomposition is that John and Paul in 2012 formulated in terms of labeled graphs, which you saw on Monday, and that makes it a lot easier to understand what's happening. So we took that, we took a result from species theory and analytic combinatorics, and we got a lot of, successfully, a lot of enumerations that were unknown until then. And it has also allowed us to get asymptotics. So I'm going to present some definitions, illustrate our approach on a simple class of graphs, and then show you a few extended results. So the context, the reason why we're interested in this, is that we, like a lot of us here, want to look at graphs using analytic combinatorics. But since graphs do not have a recursive structure, it's a little bit trickier. So the important steps that that allowed us to do what we have is, first, I don't know if it's Timonier or Avedoman, and I have been told that there are earlier references, but this paper looks at the asymptotic enumeration of cographs, and you already are starting to see a decomposition, which is the modular decomposition. Then Nakano and Al in 2007 published a paper studying distance hereditary graphs and used ad hoc methods to get a bound. And then finally, John and Paul gave characterizations of the shape of the tree that allowed us to model them with grammars. And you might wonder, you know, you might say, oh, he's talking about distance hereditary graph. This is also a very specialized graph. But if you look up on Google Scholar, which is admittedly not a good measure, you can sort of get an idea of how important these or how much talked about these graph classes are relative to each other. So if I look for a distance hereditary graph, I get, you know, 1,300 results. Compare that to planar graphs, integral graphs, perfect graphs, which are a superset of distance hereditary graphs, and so on and so on. And you know a bunch of these, and we'll be talking about some of the others. Okay, and so specifically on distance hereditary graph, this is not, you know, a class of graph that nobody has been interested in. A lot of important papers have been published on these graphs, but surprisingly, no enumeration until 2014. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what these graph decompositions are like. So this is the formal definitions that involves a bijection between the internal edges of the labels and the tree itself. But what a rooted graph labeled tree really is a tree such as this one, where there are two types of nodes. So here I then draw them to not overwhelm the picture, but you have the leaves, which are the original vertices of the graph, and you have the internal nodes, which are unrelated to the graph. They just explain the structure. But when you look at the tree, the internal labels can confuse you. And this decomposition, split decomposition that we're interested in, just like the modular decomposition, there are classes of graphs that they are able to decompose completely, and then if you make them just a little bit more complicated, you can't use those decompositions. They go into degenerate cases. And what's important about distance hereditary graph is that it's the totally decomposable class for split decomposition. In the same way that co-graphs are the completely decomposable graphs for modular decomposition. So as Marian explained to you, what underlies the split decomposition, and you don't really need to to understand, just get an idea, is that we split an internal node. Initially, the entire graph is an internal node with the vertices sticking out, and we repeatedly do a split operation where we pick a set of neighbors, a set of vertices that have the, that are completely connected, and then we just separate them. Okay, and we do so until we no longer can. So, for instance, here we no longer can decompose this node, or actually, I think we can. And that was a bad call. Michael, you were right. The up and down thing is confusing. Okay, so split decomposition. You've seen this slide. So we start from the initial graph. We apply split decomposition, and with John and Paul's understanding of what it does, which is what they introduce, we have this tree, split decomposition tree. What's important is that if the graph is totally decomposable, we'll only have these nodes. So for distance hereditary graphs and all their subsets, we're going to have this node. For any graph that is more complicated, we'll start to see prime nodes to appear. And that was the main point of Miriam and my work on cacti, is to examine prime nodes. For this talk, we're only going to stay in degenerate nodes. The theorem dates from Cunningham, 82, that there is the, once you apply the joint transformation, you can apply it up until a certain point, and these trees are canonical up to rerooting of the leaf that you start at. And so, as you've seen, we use these trees to count the graphs that they represent. One important fact that you've heard before is that what you remember from the original graph in the split tree decomposition is that when two vertices are connected, in the split decomposition graph, there's going to be an alternated path. And an alternated path is one that alternates edges that are inside the internal vertices and outside of the internal vertices. So here you have purple, pink, purple, pink, purple, pink, purple. That's an alternated path, and so these two vertices are connected. And that's very important to the second part of this. Okay, so the distance hereditary graphs are the largest class of graphs with this base, and the three-leaf power graphs are a subset of distance hereditary graphs that I hear are important in phylogenetic. And their additional constraint is that whenever in the tree there's going to be a star node such as this one, these are going to be connected and form a connected subtree, and the click nodes are going to be on the edges. So that's the sort of constraint that we then have to model and enforce in the grammar using the method that we're going to show right after. Are there any questions so far? Okay, so for those of you, for most of us, this is very familiar. For those of you who are new to our conference, this is central to our field. To count things, we break them down into small building blocks and we combine them recursively. So the building blocks either can contribute to the size with a unit weight or not. And an example of a specification, which is just a formal grammar, is, for instance, B, a leaf that does not have a weight, or a left subtree, an internal leaf that does have a weight, and a right subtree. And then we use these to have generating functions in the count. What's very nice about that is that there's a nice correspondence between the specifications and the generating functions, and through the generating functions we can get a lot of information. So that is why it is a sort of holy grail for a combinatorial object to have its specification, and why we're really excited about this. Okay, so let's start now by talking about the three-leaf power graphs. They're a subset of the heroes of this talk, the distance hereditary graphs, but they're a little bit easier to grok. So what is it? What's a three-leaf power graph? Well, it's a three-leaf power graph if it results from a tree by replacing every vertex by a click of arbitrary size. Another characterization that might be very interesting, because I've heard a lot of people talk about incremental models, but is also useful for brute force testing, is this algorithmic characterization, which is that 3LP graphs are those which you can build from a single vertex by repeatedly doing first a whole bunch of these operations and then a whole bunch of these operations. Now, what are these operations? You have a graph that's maybe just one single vertex. You pick any vertex, and that's going to be the target vertex, and then you expand it. So you can expand it by just having a pendant vertex that you hang onto it, or by having a true or strong twin, which is going to have the same neighborhood, including this edge or not, depending on whether they're true or false. But here in this case, we only have true twins. So we iterate this to get an exhaustive enumeration that's good for verification. So here are the first few 3LP graphs, where, of course, every time the blue vertex represents the vertex that was added from the smaller graph. Okay, so what's very important, and this is what unlocked, I think, a lot of things, this paper by John Paul has the characterizations of the split tree in this very digestible way. So a 3LP will have a split tree because it's a subset of distance hereditary node that's totally decomposable. It will have just the degenerate nodes, which are click and star nodes. The set of star nodes form a connected subtree of the graph. And then the center of a star node are all incident either to a leaf or to a click node. So they're facing outward from the connected tree. So this is maybe not the most intuitive description, but looking at it, it's fairly easy to then come up with this grammar of rooted 3LP graphs. And the way that we do it, as Marian was saying, is that we sort of start at the root that we had, and we travel the tree remembering which types of nodes and which types of connections we're entering. So for instance, in a star node, if we're entering through the center, we're going to have an SC term. If we're entering through the extremity, an extremity of the star, we're going to have an SX term. Okay, so if you've paid attention, if you remember Miriam's talk, these classes are rooted. They start from one place. So that's one thing that happens with 3D compositions. But like similar work that used 3D compositions, such as two connected graphs, we can then solve this problem fairly easy using the dissymmetry theorem. So this is the statement of the dissymmetry theorem, and you can get an algebraic equation on the coefficients. The sad thing is you lose the sort of symbolicity of the grammar, but there's an alternate tool for that called cycle pointing, which we've also looked at, which is a little bit more complicated but preserves the grammar, and it was introduced by Bodirsky and Allen. I think we have one of the co-authors here, Miyun. Okay, so once we apply this dissymmetry theorem, the grammar looks like this. So what's very noteworthy is that it has all the original terms that the grammar had, but it also has these rerooted tree terms. So for instance, this tree that's rerooted at a star node, or this tree that's rerooted at an edge connecting two stars, or directed edge connecting two stars. So you have the original terms coming from the rerooting of trees, and then the equation that combines it all. And then from this, you can algebraically obtain the coefficients. And so what's nice is that this of course matches with the exponential growth that we had experimentally. Okay, so then of course you can enter the grammar in Maple, and using the wonderful tools this community has built, you can get the enumeration of the entire class up to any term. Okay, and then of course what we're interested in is the asymptotic of this class. This is a fairly standard thing. We have a system of equation. We have to verify that it meets certain conditions. We translate them to equations on the generating functions, and then we compute the determinant of the Jacobian matrix. So that's something that you can do easily, again, using the tools existing in Maple. So you have here the grammar of the TLP rooted trees. You solve this, and we get the asymptotic for Z, which is 0.25. Okay, so a summary for this DH and 3LP enumeration is we've used 3LP graphs as an example, but the distance hereditary graphs aren't more complicated, just take more place in the slide. So we have what's new is an exact enumeration of both the unlabeled, labeled, unrooted, rooted cases, and the full asymptotics for every case. And we have that also for the distance hereditary graph. None of these results were known previously.
Are these algebraic generating functions?
I'm sorry?
Are these algebraic generating functions?
Algebraic generating functions? Yes.
So do you have explicit minimum polynomials for that?
No. Oh. No, the furthest we've got exploiting these things is the asymptotics of just enumeration.
So it's indirectly. Mm-hmm.
So now I'm going to switch gears a little bit for the last few minutes of this talk to show you what you can. So this was something that's very standard, you enumerate a tree. Now I'm going to tell you a little bit about the split decomposition. So for that, the easiest thing is for you to look at some simple examples to see sort of what they map at. So first example, a butterfly. So you have a triangle stuck with another triangle, so three clicks. And the way it's translated in the split decomposition is these clicks are degenerate nodes, and they are connected to this isthmus here using this star node. So you can verify that all of these nodes are connected to 4, and all of these nodes are connected to 4 because there's an alternating path, but because of this V here, anything that comes here can't be connected to anything that's there. Okay? Next example. A straight line. What does a straight line look? Well, a straight line is just a sequence of two stars, and you see how they are chained together. So you can see that one is connected to 2, but not to 3, because there's an alternating path to 2. But then there's a V, so it's not connected to any of the rest of the graph. And notice how just removing this this edge here and here changes the graph. Now, a more interesting example is the diamond, the square. What does the square look like? We fold the string that we have. Well, the square, curiously, is two stars facing each other, and these two things are connected. These two things are connected. But 2 and 1, the diagonals, wait, what am I saying?
Yeah.
The numbering, I'm sorry, the numbering here is wrong. So
yes, that should be 3.
This should be a 3, and this should be a 1. I'm very sorry for the confusion. Did I fix it here? Crap. So here's a similar example. So what's interesting here is you see the same idea of the V used to separate things that are connected. And what's most interesting to notice here is that all of these things are connected, but you see there's not really any locality. The vertices are at the end of the tree or at the leaves, so you can't just look at a specific point of the graph to know what's happening at it. You have to look at the paths that go from leaves to leaves. Okay, so this comes to an idea of what my first paper with Miriam was about, which is we noticed that if we want to avoid having any square within the graph, what we need is to avoid having two stars that are connected in their center anywhere within the graph. Okay? So it doesn't matter how close all of these things are, as long as the path exists, then this motif is going to appear as a subgraph of the graph. Okay? And by subgraph, you know, sometimes I know in graph theory it's complicated to keep in track what minor subgraph and new subgraph is, but subgraph is simply, we just look at a set of vertices and at a set of edges. Okay? So we have analog results for diamonds, for bridges, and that allows us to show a lot of results of forbidden subgraphs and find exact enumerations just from that characterization. So application, Ptolemaic graph discovered by, or invented by Hovorka and further studied by Kevin Chartrand, or maybe the opposite according to the dates. And then so this is a chordal graph. So a chordal graph, remember, is a graph that doesn't have any cycle of size 4 that doesn't have a chord. So this yes, this no. So this is a chordal graph. You can see a cycle of size 5 with 2 chords. So it's also called a triangulated graph. And you can see that with this, that what it means is a graph is chordal if it doesn't have a diamond. And we've just shown what the condition to not have a diamond is. So now, Ptolemaic graph are the subset, the intersection of chordal graph and distance hereditary graph. So we simply now need to have these trees that enforce both conditions, that are both trees containing only star and click nodes, and such that two star nodes cannot be connected by their center, as we've shown here. Okay? So here, thanks to this, we have the full grammar for these in all the cases, label 1, label 2, label 3. We have the full enumerations, which did not exist as well. We also have these components and some nice little Ptolemaic graphs here. So here's a summary. We have this for a whole bunch of classes. And what's very exciting, again, is that these are all sequences that do not exist in OEIS.
But they should exist now.
They will exist after when we've had time to process everything.
So what do you mean by exact enumeration? Closed form, generating function?
meaning that there was results on exponential bounds or some things like that, but there was no, so we don't have a closed form, but thanks to the grammar, we're able to get any term.
We have a polynomial time algorithm to generate as many terms as you want.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the very exciting things, and I guess it's the same thing that Bruno was doing in his talk, is that when you have a lot of different objects that exist in the same world, you want to see what their relationship is to each other. And not sure that we have the definite answer, but these are kind of very interesting and very pleasing visualizations. So we've had to use a logarithmic scale. We didn't use asymptotics because it had some, it didn't look quite right. So we just fixed a certain number, n equals 73, and we plotted the ratio. So for instance, what this means is that this circle is twice as big, the 2-3 cacti, twice as big as the 3 cacti, therefore there are twice as many. And the distance hereditary graph are this subset of connected graphs. Okay, and what's also interesting is that now since we have the grammars, and if somebody courageous enough to implement cycle pointing, we can have very nice random generation of these unlabeled graphs. And what's interesting is that here I have two distance hereditary graphs and two three-leaf power graphs. And even if you don't know anything about what we've done, you can see that there are two that you would tend to cluster together and two others that you would tend to cluster together. So here with the distance hereditary graph, maybe it's easier to talk about the other way. Three LP graphs, remember, what was important is that the connected subgraph of the stars. So that means it's isolating cliques and putting them on the edges a lot. So cliques are not connecting many vertices because they're not central to the tree. And that's why you see that this is fairly sparse, whereas the distance hereditary graph does not have that constraint. And so you see cliques becoming centers of gravity and absorbing, you know, a bunch of the vertices. So to conclude, what's very nice about this is that it's really, there are a lot of low-hanging fruits and exciting results to uncover and have more grammars on a lot of graphs. What's nice about having grammars on a lot of graphs is that we can do a systematic analysis of it. We can just look at all of the parameters and all of doing it in a determinate way. So the next step is doing parameter analysis. So as you've seen in the two images, there's something to say about cliques, about all sorts of things. Then there are a lot of other classes of graph, and the two interesting things is going and looking at more subclasses, because people are interested in these subclasses, even if they don't seem to be big. And then the other thing is looking at supersets, and there are several things to look at there. Looking at parity graphs, which are the immediate bigger class of graphs that is noteworthy. And it's the same thing as distance hereditary graphs, except you allow bipartite graphs as prime nodes. And then continue looking at hierarchies of graphs. You can also create artificial hierarchies of graphs that give you a better understanding of, say, the parity graph without completely enumerating them. And then some nice applications that I didn't mention, didn't have time to, but what I said about the incremental construction is very useful to have compact encodings of these graphs or compact representations, or to deduce upper bounds automatically. And then finally, of course, those of you who know me know that I really love random generation, so one of the nice things about that, and one of my main motivations to having grammars, is that you can randomly generate the objects. And I'd like to just give one last shout out, is that one other reason that it's nice to find grammars is that, I don't know how many of you know, but we have this really nice tool in our community called the Online Encyclopedia of Combinatorial Objects, or something like that. So it was created by Frédéric Chizac, Alexis Darras, Aline Bostan, and probably some people I don't remember at this moment, not in life. And this encyclopedia contains grammars and all the conveniences of having Maple in your browser. You can get however many terms you want, you can get a random object, you can get the asymptotic. And I like finding grammars because I'm hoping to grow this corpora that we have, which is complementary to OEIS and also, I think, a nice product of our community. Thank you very much for your attention.
Questions for Jeremy?
This one?
What's most important to just like pointing? It's for assignment.
I'm sorry?
What's most important here? What's most important here? Using cycle pointing as far as cycle. This was 2007, 2011. Is it a paper of multiple samplers, Bohrian theory, and cycle pointing?
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm so sorry for that. Okay, Bodishkina. Thank you, sorry for that, for mangling that reference. Another question.
In the grammar, we have to do it by hand, or is that automatic way?
For the what?
To generate the grammar themselves. You have to do it by hand, or you can do it automatically.
So which part?
But in general.
Okay, well, that's a very interesting question. That's where we want to go, of course. And I would say that right now it involves, there's handwork for two things, for determining what the correct characterization of the tree is. And the second thing that there is applying either the symmetry theorem or the cycle point. So that requires rewriting the terms in a similar way that I showed. But I think that it should be possible to automatize. And at any rate, my bigger hope for automation is the method that uses this method, that uses the encodings, because that's completely automatic. I have a specification like the one that I had here for 3LP graphs. I go from this, I specify these operations, and automatically I have a grammar. So that I think is possible. I have a grammar and I have a bound, an exponential bound that's fairly close to being tight. Thank you for your questions.
All right, well, let us thank Jeremy once again.
Control
something. Is that on HTML? No.
It's on HTML.
Oh, you
okay.
Is it on? No.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.